stick out your tongue. It's something that a doctor says to you sometimes when he wants to diagnose what's wrong with you. Often, looking at your tongue or your mouth, he can tell, get a good idea what might be wrong with you. And that's pretty true in the spiritual sense, too. If I have a look at what you say, I probably have a pretty good idea what's going on in your heart. And Peter found that out one night when Jesus was on trial. He spoke up when it probably would have been better that he didn't. And people learned some things about him that he didn't want them to know. They listened to his dialect, his accent, and said, "You're from Galilee. You must be one of Jesus' disciples." And people can listen to us. They can listen to the words that we say, and they can probably have a pretty good idea about our education. They can listen to our accent, and they might have an idea where we come from. So my question for you is today, what is your tongue saying about you? The title this morning comes from Titus 2, 6 to 8. The title is Sound Speech, Which is Beyond Reproach. Likewise, urge the young men to be sensible. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds with purity and doctrine, dignified. And this is the part that we're going to focus on today. Sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. So this morning I want to look at three different examples, and two of them in particular are kind of a compare and contrast between sound speech and not sound speech, and particularly want to look at speech that is true and honest and open and transparent, or speech that is manipulative and political and lying and trying to give the wrong impression. So I'm going to read Acts 24. I'm going to read in the New American Standard Bible. But I'd like you, instead of turning to that, I'd like you to just listen. And as we read through there, there's mainly two people that are talking. And I'd like you to analyze whether it's lies and deception and manipulation, or if it's truth and honesty and openness and reality. So, and I'd like you to vote with your hands on what's going on. And if you think that it is lies and manipulation and not transparency, put up your left hand. And if it looks like truth, put up your right hand as we read through this chapter. So I'm going to read it and you listen and you tell me what you think is going on in this chapter. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders. And this is Paul's trial. He's coming before the governor there, and Paul is on trial. So they have this attorney who is representing the Jews who are trying to get Paul in trouble, and Paul defending himself. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with an attorney named Tertullus, and brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness." Now remember, you're putting your hands up. Is he speaking truth or lies? And you know, you can be wrong, that's okay, but as we're reading, just keep your one hand up or the other. Your left if it's no good, and your right if you think he's speaking the truth. "We acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. For we have found this man to be a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law, but Lysias the commander came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so." When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge of this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which you now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God that which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before both before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified, without any crowd or uproar. But there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been here, been present before you to make accusation, if they should have anything against me. Or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than that, for the one statement which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. But Felix, having a more exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will decide your case. Then he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody, and yet to have some freedom and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. But some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. But as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, left Paul imprisoned. So you can, if you want to, you can turn to this chapter. But I'd like you to let's go through what. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. What were the lies that, particularly Tertullus, he was probably the worst offender. What was he saying? What were the lies or the half-truths or the manipulation or the flattery that he was sharing? Acts 24. So what were some of the lies? Yeah, did they really appreciate him as a governor, and it was very peaceful? I mean, not just was Roman rule not very peaceful with the Jews, but this man in particular, if you look at history, didn't have a very smooth rule. There was mismanagement, there was corruption, there was a rebellion which he dramatically crushed. I mean, it was not peaceful. What else? Statements that are just 100% always, never, seldom are true. And all thankfulness. How many of the Jews were thankful for his rule? Almost none. What else? Yeah, that was pretty backwards. There was a lot of violence going on, and the commander came and saved Paul from the violence, not created violence, definitely. What else? This fella is a pest. A lot of people didn't like Paul, but I don't think calling him a pest was very accurate. What else? He tried to profane the temple. Now, it is true they may have thought that to be true, but it wasn't true either way. So, yeah, they were just accuse, lies. First they flatter him, compliment him, and then they make this accusation. Now, I don't very often quote comic strips, but there's an interesting story from the Peanuts comic strip. They're coming back to school, and their assignment on the first day is to write a little essay about what it means to come back from school vacation. So Lucy writes this story about how, I should just read it. It says, vacations are nice, but it's good to get back to school. There's nothing more satisfying or challenging than education, and I look forward to a year of expanding knowledge. Of course, the teacher really liked this. And she leans over to her classmate after that she was complimented for her essay and said, after a while, you learn what sells. And aren't we all tempted to say what sells? We say what people want to hear. Makes our life easier, right? And that's just not the way Christians ought to be living. It just really isn't. So let's take a look at the second part of the chapter. Let's analyze Paul's defense. What do you how to compare and contrast it to Tertullus? Like, I think most of you agreed that what he said was true. So analyze it. What do you think of his? Pick out some points of his defense that you appreciate that were true. It was absolutely true. He did know about it was true. It was an honest compliment, I think. I'm sure it was difficult to find an honest compliment for Felix, but he did begin with an honest compliment. It was true.
The one that jumped out at me was verse 14, where it says, but this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets.
He said, yes, they're accusing me of being a Christian. And I am a Christian. He was very clear about that. Didn't deny it.
Like 16, where he says, herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men.
Says, I do my best to follow what I believe to be true. And he even came out and confessed. He said, I violated my conscience when I was before the council. He said, I stooped to political maneuvering, and I said, it's about the resurrection. And he said, that wasn't following my conscience. And I admit I shouldn't have done that. I'm using my own words, but I think he admitted I was wrong in that. And I shouldn't have done that. He was very specific. He said it was 12 days ago. He laid this out. He's like, here's what I was doing. I got here 12 days ago. And he kind of goes down through. He refutes their claims. He says, I wasn't making a disturbance. I was purified when I was in the temple. And he witnessed to his captors. He told them about Jesus, especially later on as he would keep calling him back, hoping for a bribe. He began to witness to this man. And so much so that he said, it's not a convenient time today. Maybe I'll talk to you later. He got uncomfortable, and he refused to pay a bribe. He said, I'm not going to do that. Now let's turn to Daniel chapter 6, and we're going to look at another compare and contrast. And I won't make you raise your hands for this one. I'm going to read Daniel 6, 1 to 11. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was found to be in him. Then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. So, well, I won't read the rest of the story, but this is what these people were saying. So, who can tell me why did the king appoint these people over the kingdom? He had these 120 and then 3 over them. It says, it gives us a clue why the king appointed them. So there's no damage to the king. Were these maybe his, I'm imagining a little bit here, but were these his anti-corruption officers? They were to look out and make sure that no one was stealing money or wasting money. I'm guessing a little bit here, but it seems that way to me. And so this was, these people were to look out, make sure he wasn't suffering loss, there was no damage. But just compare Daniel to all the rest of these people. And, you know, these people were bothered by Daniel, and so they had this secret agenda. But Daniel was completely transparent. You know, he was willing to pray with the windows open. And these people agreed to do evil. Talks about a couple times. They met by agreement. You know, they made these plans. They were scheming together. But Daniel stood on his own. He didn't need anyone else to stand with him. He stood by himself against these 122 others, at least probably, that were coming against him. And they tried to take down a good man. And it doesn't say exactly why, but again, I'm surmising a little bit. It seems to me like either they were corrupt and they didn't like his lack of corruption, or they were incompetent and they didn't appreciate his competence. It seems like one of those two things. And they believed that everybody is corrupt in some way. Everybody, there's a saying, everybody has a price, right? For enough of money, you'll do something you shouldn't do, right? Well, that's not true of people of integrity. And they thought surely there was some way that either he was lazy or corrupt, and they could find it. And they said, this is not going to, and they started looking, they started digging, you know, this is how politics works. You dig up dirt on people, right? And they couldn't find anything. He was diligent in his work, and he was 100% honest. There wasn't any cheating or anything. And likely they thought that he was a threat to their corruption or their incompetence or their laziness, whatever it was. And they said, you know, we believe that everybody's corrupt somewhere. But they discovered that that wasn't true. Daniel wasn't. He proved that you can be a leader of integrity. And so finally they stooped to using his belief in God against him, because he said that's the only way we can take him out. But Daniel boldly served God in spite of this, even though he knew that that's what they were going to do. Also, they lied and they said that all these people, we all agreed together that this would be a good law. Wasn't true. But Daniel trusted God, and it doesn't seem like he was even concerned by their threats. It's a story I read recently about a minister in a church, and they were having trouble that people weren't giving money in the offering, and so there wasn't enough money. And so one Sunday he stood up and he said, "Now before we pass the collection plate, I would like to request that the person who stole chickens from Brother Martin's hen house please refrain from giving any money to the Lord. The Lord doesn't want money from a thief." Well, an interesting thing happened. Everybody gave that morning. While it might have been a good outcome, it wasn't a good method. That's manipulation, and that's not the way to get people to give money. And we contend, I know this is something that I've struggled with and God convicted me about. Doesn't matter what the outcome, you've got to use means of integrity. You can't manipulate. It's not the way to get even good things to happen. So let's not be like that. I'd like to turn to another passage, Luke 23:13-25. We've looked at people who lie and manipulate and flatter. And this passage is a little bit different. Some people wanted to get some things done, and they had a politician, and he was used to this culture of pleasing everyone to keep his position. And so the people used this to manipulate him. This is Jesus' trial, and we're not going to look at the main story, but rather a little part of how these people manipulated this politician. Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion, and behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us, and behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. Therefore, I will punish him and release him." Now he was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner. But they cried out all together, saying, "Away with this man and release for us Barabbas." He was one who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city and for murder. Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again, but they kept on calling out, saying, "Crucify, crucify him." And he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore, I will punish him and release him." But they were insistent with loud voices, asking that he be crucified. And their voices began to prevail. I find that phrase really interesting. I don't know if their voices so much prevail as Pilate started to step back from standing on what he knew to be true. He left these loud mouths overcome him. And next sentence is, and Pilate pronounced the sentence that their demand be granted, and he released the man they were asking for, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, but he delivered Jesus to their will. So this is a different method that some people get to get their way. They kick and scream and shout and threaten. And Pilate, who wasn't a man of integrity, finally gave in. And it's really tempting to give in when we know something's true, but people are kicking and screaming and threatening, and we finally get tired of standing up for what's true. And we say, all right, fine, have it your way. And it reminds me a little bit of today's political protesters sometimes. You know, if we kick and scream and shout and burn things down, maybe we can finally get our way. And too often they do, because some of our leaders aren't people of integrity. It reminds me of one preacher I heard of. He had in his notes, someone saw, it said, after one of his points, it said, "Weak point, pound the pulpit and shout." And you know, if we have a belief or a point or something we're trying to say that we have to shout and pound the pulpit or get angry and loud about, probably not a very strong point. And so when you hear someone shouting and getting angry and loud about something they believe, you better suspect that it's probably not true. Or be careful about it at least. So I'd like to look a little bit more now at what we face today. What are some words that manipulators have corrupted to deceive and manipulate us? There are a lot of words that people use today that sound good and wonderful, but they hide kind of this darker meaning, or they change the meaning to get their way, to accomplish, to manipulate, to do something. What are some words that you think of that don't mean the same thing today that they used to mean, because people are using them to get their way or to accomplish something that's not good? Two prices, one on the shelf and one at the checkout. I mean, mistakes can happen, but yeah, we assume that it was intentional. Mm-hmm. That didn't used to mean the same thing.
When I was growing up, gay men were happy.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. I have a list, and you maybe can think of more, I'm sure. Equity sounds wonderful, right? Disinformation, gender-affirming care, racism, democracy, a Nazi, privilege, tolerance, diversity, safe space. And a lot of these words have come to mean the complete opposite of what they meant before because they're used in a different way. And they sound good if you don't understand what the intent is behind the way they're used. And some of these that I fell prey to, thinking, oh, well, that sounds pretty good. You know, we should be tolerant. Yes, well, we should be, but what does it really mean? It's often intolerance. And I think in a lot of cases, it's invaded Christian churches. There are a lot of Christian churches who have just swallowed this, and it's really awful. It's hiding evil. It really is. Isaiah had something to say with this. Isaiah 5:20, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of ones who are right." Words are powerful things. I'm sure you've probably all heard the quote, "Give me 26 lead soldiers and I'll conquer the world." I'd like for someone, maybe a teenager, to explain that to me. And it's been attributed to various people, so I don't know who said it first. But someone, a teenager, explained to me what that means when it says, "Give me 26 lead soldiers and I'll conquer the world." Winston Churchill definitely said it. Benjamin Franklin said it. Different people said it. What does it mean? Or maybe explain, what is a lead soldier? It's a good guess, but it's not right. You're right, it has to do with words. You got to go further back in history to figure out what a lead soldier is. Okay, it can be anyone that knows. What's a lead soldier? Yes, 26 letters in the alphabet, and the type in the printing press was made of lead. And basically what he was saying is, if I can publish something, I can do more to change the world than I can with soldiers and guns. Propaganda is more powerful than weaponry. And words have certainly been used that way. Another question for you: how might we be susceptible to flattery today? And what ways could flattery change us in ways that it shouldn't? How could someone use flattery to change our minds in a bad way? While you're thinking about that, I'm going to read some verses. Psalms 12:1-4. "Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases to be, for the faithful disappear from among the sons of men. They speak falsehood to one another. With flattering lips and a double heart they speak. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips, the tongue that speaks great things, who have said, 'With our tongue we will prevail, our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us?'" Flattery is a powerful thing. In what ways, or how could we, maybe this is a pretty broad question, but there are a lot of different answers. What are ways that we might be susceptible? How could we be flattered?
We fall for that quicker than somebody says, "You're always this," or you're forever like that. And I think we should watch for that, that grain of truth with untruth.
And that's true about deception very broadly, is that it's easier to fall for untruth than when it's mixed with truth, for sure. Any other ways we could fall for flattery? There's one thing in particular that I think a weakness that makes us vulnerable to flattery, and that's pride. If we are truly humble and we're not proud, then we shrug it off. Yeah, sure. And I think we should be willing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think some people like to give us compliments about our character, and being Christian people, we like to accept those. They say, you know, you're an intelligent person, then you should do what I want you to do. Or you're an honest, I can tell you're an honest person. How about this or that or the other thing?
Character compliments, true compliments. And to be fair, I think we should accept compliments. We should give the glory to God, but we should accept them. It's not that we should ignore compliments, and it can be difficult to tell the difference, but I think it is important that we reject flattery, because we will, yeah, it will harm us for sure. Go ahead.
I'm thinking of Saul, how he became very susceptible to flattery. He started out humble, and then he became proud, right? I think we can be humble without being anchored in God and our identity. So, and if we are humble but not anchored in our identity, not anchored in God, we will become susceptible to pride and thus flattery. I think having our identity firmly anchored in Him and our value coming from Him is an addition to our humility that is essential to be there in order to become impervious to flattery.
And I've wondered already, I don't know, but you know, we have Saul, you know, he's hiding when he's called to be the leader. Well, that was an humble response, I would say, but was it really availability to God? Was that the beginning of a problem that became worse? Maybe. I don't know the answer to that. It's not really our point, but accepting the leadership role that God called him without running off and hiding, would have that been a better way? I don't know the answer to that, but I've wondered about that already. And yes, we need to acknowledge God in it, not think of ourselves too highly or too lowly. We're not worthless. God does care about us. You know, and praise, and of any kind, really is a test. Solomon says in Proverbs, the crucible is for silver and the furnace for gold. So you heat something really hot. You see what's really there to get rid of the bad. And each is tested by the praise accorded to him. When we're praised, it's a test of who we really are. We all hopefully receive praise, some of it good, some of it not sincere, but it's a test for us to say, what are we really made of? Jesus said, woe to you when all men speak well of you, for their fathers used to treat the false prophets in the same way. We can appreciate when people speak well, but when everyone's speaking well of us, we're probably not saying the truth. Probably trying to say what sells. A related question, when might we be tempted to flatter other people? So we kind of turn the tables. When might we be tempted to do something like that? When we want to manipulate. So if our motives are good, we probably won't flatter.
Flattering someone to make them feel good so the need can be met.
We feel like there's no other way, or someone who won't be appealed to any other way. There's some people that you probably won't get them to do what you think they should unless you flatter them. And are we gonna stoop to that, or are we not? But I want to say too, though, that we should always encourage people. We should build them up. We should thank them. We should give them honest compliments, like Paul did to the governor. I'm sure that he wasn't a very complimentary person, but he found something to compliment him on. And so we should do those things. You know, flattery is saying nice things to manipulate. It's, you know, often untrue. But Solomon said in Proverbs again, he who rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. If you flatter someone, they're going to eventually realize that you weren't being honest. You were flattering them. You were manipulating them. And it's better off to rebuke someone, even though they might not like you at the moment. That relationship will be better off. So let's be people who are sound in speech, that use our words unselfishly to communicate clear truths that help the people around us. It's a short poem by Mr. Bosch. Take my tongue and bridled well, words of truth it e'er may tell. Take my heart, its wellspring deep, cleanse and purify and keep. I'd like to close with a quote from Senator John Kennedy. He just said recently, he was talking about speaking the truth. And he said, you're going to be called crazy. Many people also called Noah crazy. And then the rains came and all the fact checkers died. So let's be a Noah.